Austria and surrounding countries. Landau was one of the greatest writers of response of his time. His Note of Yehuda, two parts, Prague, 1776-1811, contains some 860 responses. It has been frequently published with glosses and commentaries by some of the greatest rabbis of succeeding generations. The most important of his other books are Tzion Nefesh Chaya, on the tractates Psachim, Brachot, Beitzah. An edition including all of these appeared in 1925, and one on Seder Nezikin with various editions in 1959. Tavul Miravava, 1794, on the Shulchan Aruch. Yerushei Hatzlach, 1899. Ahavat Tzion, Sermons and Addresses, 1827. All are frequently republished. Landau took an active part in all the Jewish social and religious events of his time. He identified himself absolutely with the traditional Jewish way of life, regarding its preservation and welfare as his primary duty. It was for that reason that he advocated ending the controversy with Eibeschütz, even though he was of the opinion that the accusations leveled against him could not easily be dismissed. On the other hand, he persecuted those who were known as Shabbateans, and in particular Frankists. For the same reason, he was averse to the study of Kabbalistic literature, had served them as a prop, and he even opposed vigorously the Hasidim of Israel ben Anasaz and Bar Shem Tov as deviating from the authentic road of Judaism. On the other hand, Landau looked with some favor on the Haskalah movement. When, however, the aggressive anti-rabbinic tendency amongst the Maskilim of Berlin grew stronger, he regretted this support, and his attitude towards them took an unfavorable turn. The Miasrim came to regard him as their arch-enemy, while he, in turn, referred to them as a rabble of unclean birds. Despite this, he continued to support the traditional element amongst Maskilim, giving his approbation to books on history, grammar, natural sciences, etc. Landau distinguished himself in his attitude to the new situation arising from the opening of the gates of the ghetto and the conquest of the Jews into general non-Jewish society. He toiled and pleaded with sincerity for a strengthening of correct relationship with non-Jews and the development of a feeling of patriotism for the country. His benedictory message to the first Jewish recruits of the Austrian army made a strong impression. He also cooperated in the establishment of the first Jewish school in Prague, although several weeks previously had come out strongly against the attempt of Naftali Hertz Vasily to attach religious significance to general education. Among his rulings are original and bold, lenient decisions which testify both to his responsible approach to the community and to his mastery of the halacha, enabling him to effect a compromise between it and the demands of his time. One of his best-known lenient rulings was the permission to shave on the intermediate days of the festival, which caused a storm in the rabbinic world at the time. This, as many other of his lenient decisions, was set aside by the halakhic authorities of the following generation, for example, the Chatam Sofer. He was also the first to permit, albeit with severe restriction, autopsies.
So we read that Shuvah.
We read that Shuvah, and we also read the debate between the Chatam Sofer and the Benin of Yehuda on the issue. I'll come back to his son, Samuel Landau, in a moment. I want to read just briefly two selections from this book. Yes, those were the masculine of both Berlin and in Eastern Europe. Mild masculine, not reformed. The people who were pushing for secular education and broadening of Jewish education.
So is it the same for the
Well, the Maskilim referred to a specific group of Maskilim that lived at that particular time. There's a journal called Hamaaseh, which is our journal that is. Alongside with the Habsburg House reformers and the, quote, tobacco Jews, because the Jews were heavily involved in the tobacco industry, in Hungary, in the Austro-Hungarian Empire. The cultural enlightenment of Western Christian society had a strong impact on 18th century Bohemian Jewry, opening it to modern ideas. This happened especially at Prague, which was still, in the 18th century, one of Christian Europe's greatest cities, with its legendary 100 church spires, its spacious castle, which occasionally housed the imperial court, its graceful gardens, its ancient university, and its bustling commerce. Almost inevitably, in such an environment, Jews became sensitive to the changing world around them, to new currents, new attitudes. Despite an interruption caused by the temporary expulsion of 1744-45 under the Great Fire in the Judenstadt in 1754. This city was, in Maria Theresa's reign, the center where Ashkenazis were most susceptible to the new ideas of the West. One should not imagine that the Prague-Jewish enlightenment reached the level of Westernization attained further north at Moses Mendelssohn's Berlin. At Prague, at the end of Maria Theresa's reign, there were Jewish doctors trained at German universities practicing, a Dr. Jonas Jaikulis and a Dr. Abraham Kish, as well as a stratum of Jews who were dressing like Christians and who could converse on subjects of Christian learning. Jaikulis, in particular, corresponded with enlighteners elsewhere in Europe and published books on medical topics which were widely read in his profession. But he was no Moses Mendelssohn, no precocious scholar emerging from a traditional Jewish background, learning the tongues and scientific methods of the European New Age. Alongside Jewish Berlin's active contribution to the Western Enlightenment, what happened in Jewish Prague was modest indeed. Nonetheless, there was a Prague Jewish Enlightenment, and it flourished because of a peculiar circumstance within the autonomous framework of Prague Jewry. In Maria Theresa's day, the chief rabbi of the Prague community was Ezekiel Landau, a renowned Talmudist and a relentless warrior against Sabbatism, and he initially assumed an open stance on matters of Jewish enlightenment. It was in the absence of his disapproval that Mendelssohn's early, pre-1783 work, at least, gained a wide reading by students from all over Central and Eastern Europe who come to study in Prague. How could this be? How could a distinguished Orthodox rabbi act somehow as a transmitter of Enlightenment ideas? The answer is surely, in part, that Jewish tradition was not yet what it became in the 19th century. Perhaps one may say that in Landau's day, it bound personal piety, avid adherence to the devotional law, and respect for Jewish learning to a philosophical flexibility recalling the naive ecumenism of pre-Reformation Roman Christianity. It was no doubt extremely dogmatic, close to outside ideas, but it was also extremely diverse and contentious and not insensitive to new scientific uses of the mind. Furthermore, the Orthodox then recognized a major foe within Judaism that was Mahaskalah, the Enlightenment. This was heresy, for which most part, their main foe was heresy, which for the most part meant Sabbatianism, false messianism. Even the Mitnagdim, the self-sustained opponents who assumed to lead in Polish Jewish Lithuanian Jewry in the late 18th century, were not initially opposed to Haskalah. They opposed Hasidism and its pietist emphasis. Only later did they come to distrust the reformers from the West. Landau's priorities were similar. So Landau was open to scientific ideas. Now I'm reading from a little later in this book. For the essence of the story, one must go back to where we left the Bohemian Jews in an earlier chapter, to the epoch of Ezekiel Landau, the seeming latitudinarian over-rabbiner of Prague. We can start with a key event. When, in the fall of 1781, Rabbi Landau heard about Kaiser Joseph's new Bohemian Judenpatent, he decided, despite the Kaiser's explicit cancellation of many old Jewish self-governmental rights, to give the new laws public welcome. What is more, together with Joachim Pacher, the primator of the Bohemian rural Jews, and Lerbel Gripchenis, primator of the Prague Jews, he actively collaborated in the fateful project of establishing a Jewish German language modern school at Prague. This is sort of the first school in which secular languages and secular subjects were taught with the official approval of the chief rabbi. And so he continued through the decade. Even in 1788, when Joseph decided to require military service over the Bohemian Jews, Landau and the Primitors cooperated, though this was a matter of high alarm for practicing Jews. Then Landau himself appeared at the induction center to bless the first 25 Austrian Jewish military inductees, etc. So you can see that this is a great man, one of the last great figures of rabbinic Judaism, who is open to the modern world to some extent. Okay, so much for the note of Yehuda. Now, going back to what you had before, two more key players in our fish story are the son of the note of Yehuda, Samuel, who's on page 2 of the handout that I gave you. Samuel died in 1834, graduated from his father's yeshiva. In the early years, he moved in Prag Haskalah circles and was associated with the Gesellschaft der Jungen Hebräer. It is generally assumed that Ezekiel did not formally pronounce the ban on Moses Mendelssohn's translation of the Bible because Samuel's name appeared on the list of those who subscribed to the work. Having become strictly Orthodox, he applied for the office of Av Beis Din after his father's death, but was not appointed. His objections to the establishment of rabbinical cemeteries were the main subject of the pamphlet HaOreg. He was elected to the Beit Din and later became Av Beit Din. In 1799, Samuel and Eleazar Fleckless signed a cheirem against the Frankists, and a year later, on November 11th, he and Fleckless were imprisoned for 4 days in connection with a scandal at a Frankist funeral, etc. So you have that on Shmuel Landau. Next in the Landau story, which I did not hand out, is Fleckless. He was a student of the Nodav Yehuda. Fleckless Eliezer ben David, rabbi and author. Born in Prague, Fleckless studied under Meir Fischelis, Moses Cohen Rofe, and Ezekiel Landau. In 1779, he was appointed rabbi of Koyotin in Moravia, but in 1783 returned to Prague, where he served as a member of the Beit Din for Ezekiel Landau and also handed a law to Shiva. After Landau's death, Fleckless was appointed overjurist, president of the Freeman Rabbinic Council, which also included Samuel Landau, the son of Ezekiel. Okay, now we come to some of these two are well-known rabbanim, and in fact my goal, which I will only partly get to tonight, will be to study three tshuvot which appeared in the Sheilot tshuvot of the Nodav Yehuda. One was written by the Nodav Yehuda himself, the second was written by his son in response to these various other characters who, as you say, made a career of fighting this particular psak of the Nodav Yehuda. And the third is an earlier tshuva of the Nodav Yehuda dealing with isinglass. Remember that if you decide, as we do today, that the sturgeon is not a kosher fish, then becomes the issue of whether you can drink beer. And in fact, the Nodav Yehuda, before he had to deal with actual kashrut or lack thereof of the scarlet, was simply posed with an abstract problem of what happens if you use the isinglass made from a non-kosher fish, can you drink the beer, and so on. So there he gave a psak halacha earlier than the ones that we begin to study, in which he decided that one and therefore we can today drink beer and don't have to worry about the fact that even though we decide that the sturgeon is not a kosher fish, we're allowed to drink the beer that's manufactured in Turkey.
Right.
Don't be so sure. For example, it hinges on a related problem, that of the use of gelatin, in which there's a...
Which you were involved in the breweries too, right?
Oh, yes.
So where does isinglass... I missed it. Where does isinglass come from? Was it sturgeon?
From the swim bladder of the sturgeon. The swim bladder, the thing that uses to raise and lower itself. Okay, now,
the only thing they could use to purify or cultivate beer, nothing else would do it.
Not as well.
I think sound special.
Okay, now comes the next major player in this story, who is Aaron Chorin, and here the situation is reversed. The old Jewish encyclopedia has a long laudatory article on Chorin. Do you have it?
Yeah.
The one only has a little paragraph.
The new one has just a little paragraph, correct.
Why, was the old one written by German?
Well, no, so he's Hungarian.
The early encyclopedia was written by scholars.
Not all. I mean, Louis Ginsberg.
That's the old one.
Schechter, yeah. I'm going to read to you from the New Jewish Encyclopedia. So you have a long discussion of Aaron Chorin and his ups and downs, and the stuff that I've handed out from the Old Jewish Encyclopedia. I'm going to briefly read from the New Jewish Encyclopedia. Chorin, Aaron, 1766 to 1854. Pioneer of Reform Judaism in Hungary. Born in Hranice, Moravia, Horan studied for 2 years in the yeshiva of Matusdorf, and then at that of Ezekiel Landau in Prague, where in addition to his religious studies, he required knowledge of general philosophy and developed an interest in Kabbalah. He was appointed rabbi of Arad in 1789. Where is Arad exactly in Hungary?
Arad. Arad is in Romania.
Now in Romania.
I said he found out from the north of the south, he started to figure, for the dying father.
I see. And in 1803, published in Prague his Emek HaShaveh, attacking those customs which he declared had no basis in Judaism, basing his reforms on rulings in the Talmud. What caused the storm among the ultra-Orthodox who found it heretical? Mordechai Bannett of Nikolsburg appealed to the community of Rad to ban the book. Korn was summoned to appear before a Betin, who ordered the book to be burned and compelled him to recant in writing. However, Horan appealed to the government, which set aside the verdict. Horan began abrogating customs such as kaparot and placing copies of the Psalms or a saint or a woman in childbirth. But in the course of time, he extended his reforms, particularly to the synagogue liturgy, abolishing the Kol Nidre prayer, as did Samson of Royal Hirsch, changing the text of other prayers, permitting prayer in the vernacular with uncovered head, and approving the use of the organ on the Sabbath.
He went to yeshiva.
Yeah, Notable Hillel's yeshiva. He also curtailed the 7 days of mourning and permitted writing and writing on the Sabbath. In his article, Kishirnat HaEmet, he supported the reforms of Israel Jacobson. In Davar B'Yitel, he maintained that love of God and humanity take precedence over the positive commandments. Okay, and so on. So this is more or less brief. I think we should read a bit from
now,
the...
He was appointed as a rabbi.
Right. No. This is before the existence of the Reform. He's one of the pioneers of the Reform. There wasn't such a concept of the Orthodox. Where is the Koran?
You have to read in the biography that he was married 17 years old.
That was pretty old to get married in those days. Most people got married at age 13 or 14.
Really?
Yeah.
The girls even know that.
Where is this here? I don't seem to have one. Do you have it? Someone read to me just the beginning. Here, I'll... Here. Horan. Hungarian rabbi, born at Weisskirch in Moravia, August 1766, died in Arad, Hungary, August 24, 1844. At the age of 14, he studied in Yeshiva Rabbi Jeremias in Matusdorf, Hungary, and 2 years later in Prague at the Higher Talmudical Academy of Ezekiel Landau. Here he also learned German. Horan married December 26, 1783, and entered commerce, but his business career being unsuccessful, he accepted the post of rabbi at Arad in the spring of 1789, which position he occupied until his death. His first work. In 1798, Horan published his first pamphlet, Imre Noah, Words of Pleasantness, in which he argued that as the surgeon has scales, it was permitted food according to scripture. His opinion, although following that of Ezekiel Landau and other authorities, was strongly opposed by Mordechai Bennett and his partisans. Rabbi Isaac Kreishaber of Pax wrote a refutation, Makel Noam, I have the actual book upstairs, which is called forth a second pamphlet by Horan called Shiryon Kaskasim, and so on. So the first act of Horan, which caused this violent controversy, was the simply repeating what he learned probably from the Noda Yehuda, namely that the sturgeon is the sterlet is a kosher fish, as the Ramban also said. And his leading rabbinical opponent, the person who had some authority, was Mordechai Bannett. So let me read to you the biography of Mordechai Bannett. Mordechai ben Abraham, Moravian rabbi, one of the leading Talmudists of his time, 1753 to 1829. Bannett was born in Psura, Sorgo of Hungary. He studied at the Yeshiva of Perth under Yosef Spanhart, author of the Responsa Zichron Yosef. I don't didn't hand this out. In 1784, he was appointed Dayan in Nikolsburg or Moravia. And Nikolsburg was the chief town in Moravia, like Prague was the chief town in Bohemia. In 1787 and 1788, he served as rabbi of Lindenburg, Moravia, and subsequently as Szaszfar, Hungary, and from 1789 acted as rabbi and head of the yeshiva in Nikolsburg and district rabbi of Moravia. Bonnet's yeshiva attracted students from near and far, and during the 40 years that he headed it, several thousand students passed through. Bonnet fought vigorously against the reform movement, particularly against Aaron Horen, and he vehemently opposed the founding of the Reformed Temple on Hamburg. At the same time, he displayed a certain understanding of the spiritual needs of his contemporaries. At the request of the government, he prepared two courses of study for students of the rabbinate, which included secular studies. The courses were published in Toldot Mordechai Banet of his son Yaakov Avraham. Under Banet's influence, his son Naftali Banet compiled a handbook in Hebrew and German on the fundamentals of the Jewish religion. Because of his great influence on his community, his talent and leadership, and the support of his government, Wardo succeeded in postponing the Banner, it should say, succeeded in postponing the disintegration of Moravian Jewry for at least one generation. Later, than that of the breakup of Bohemian Jewry. He was one of the chief opponents of Saul Berlin and the controversy of his work for Southern Rose. So that's Mordechai Banner. All of these people, with the exception of Aaron Horan, of course, are known as Rabbanim in the Jewish halachic tradition. Now there are two small players here, Grishavim, Isaac. This is the sum total of what it says in the Encyclopedia Judaica. Grishavim died 1815, Hungarian rabbi. Born in Krakow, Grishavim went in 1782 to Hungary and was appointed rabbi of Paks. Where is Paks?
Near the Danube River.
For an unknown reason, he left this community and went to serve the community of Baja, but towards the end of his life, he returned to Fox. He was in halakhic correspondence with Ezekiel Landau, author of the Note of Yehuda, and studied under him for a while in Prague, as well as with Moses Sofer. Grishavim was resolute in his views and fought for them stubbornly and courageously. He was involved in a violent controversy in 1798-99 because of his dispute with Rabbi Aaron Horan as one of the Spurgeon is kasher. He published a pamphlet on this subject, Makel Noam, which I said I have upstairs, giving his reasons for forbidding the fish, with supporting letters from contemporary rabbis in Hungary and elsewhere. Okay, and I don't have Horan's little pamphlet, but somehow or other it's missing, or I can't get at it in the Harvard Library, maybe by next week. Alright, so now we know some of the history of the communities and some of the key players. Now let's start studying the actual arguments here.
As they want to decide about something, what they think on the spiritual world that they think is going to help define whether they're liberal or
reactive. Well, I don't know completely the answer to this, but I tried to present it earlier. First of all, there were always two conflicting traditions about the spirit. And most likely, the Sephardic Jewish community, which managed to stay in Hungary, in the but the Jewish community, the Sephardim in Hungary, who were there because of the Turkish conquest in 1526, was it, in 1541, had a tradition of eating the sturgeon. The immigrants found this distasteful, and as I said, there are actual real reasons for it. So here is, again, a situation not too dissimilar to the Hungarian immigrants to the United States, who found many of the current Jewish practices amongst
the
this was, and as I said, some of them found the sturgeon repulsive. If you didn't eat it, it certainly maybe didn't look like a fish. But now let's read some of the texts and the arguments on both sides. So now let's come to the first place in which we're actually reading a halakhic text. And this you should have. It's She'elot u'tshuvot merav Yehuda Madura Pnina Yerodeya Siman Chafpet. It's relatively short and to the point. And probably you won't get past it tonight and then move on to the others next week. Shuva Doma Dalil Tzvi La'oka Notenim Reshech Eshkel La'koka Adon Neharuvi Yediri Bachaviti Arach Agarol Moroz etc. Tzvi Hersh Segal Abbezden Dutkila Kadisha 2, I don't know what that is. Mechtavol Higiani Machrat Yonach Kekorim Im Hadak. Your letter came to me with a fish, so he was obviously sent a specimen of the fish.
You smell that one. You smell that one coming.
Ve'hine asher sha'al im l'smoch al edut ha-me'idim ha-oklim otel b'mkomam. Can you rely on the testimony of those who have a tradition of eating this fish? Hine, l'inyon ne'emonut ha'ed, as far as the believability of the witness is concerned, ha'vadai de'ed echad me'emon b'yisurin echad de'lo chazik yisur. A single witness is to be believed in a matter of Yisur v'hedev. Ha'kal v'choma sh'yesh kan edut shnayim v'yoteh. We have testimony of at least two or more who say they actually ate this fish. Ela de'lusha yiyesh ye'ochlin otan b'mkomot ha'hem. But the fact that they did eat this fish in those particular communities, akati imchlu le'chol b'mkoman shekvar hogulu le'isur, but can this change the practice of those who are accustomed not to eat this fish? Al smach b'mkomot ahein, can you use the testimony that some distant community, some other community did eat the fish, and your community up until now has accustomed not to eat this fish, can you rely on that for eating the fish? Hadavar taloi b'plukta b'yordeya siman pebeis if hey, b'tam ha'oser sham, the reason that someone who says that you cannot rely on such testimony, who, m'pnei sh'ulai b'mkamultam, yesh ofot t'meim hadomim la'elu, shayach gam b'dagim. Since certain communities may refuse to eat a species of bird, even though in principle it's kasher, because it's so similar to a non-kasher bird, that might also apply to fish. Hecha she'en lahem kaskeset. In the case of a fish that doesn't have a scale. Rak she'vektzat mekamot na'ruvo heter she'en mekubalim sham she'men shirim b'mayim. Even though they have a tradition that you are allowed to eat this fish because the fish loses its scales in the waters. Bal kolpanim kevan she'en lo kaskesin l'faneinu shuv hu mutzad ha'efshar sh'yumin et me'im damim lo v'tachbito v'ma'uto v'mekamot acherim. Therefore, there might be a valid reason for prohibiting the eating of this fish because it's too similar to a fish which actually may be really tricked. Your community is an old community. Nobody can remember the reason for not eating this particular fish. Anina siti dagze. I examined this fish. I experimented on this fish. Yesh lo shtei shurot kaskasin, shura achat betzad yamin, shura achat betzad smol. It has, actually, the sterlet has more than two rows of scale, but he's referring to things which he will be able to remove. Uma b'kach she'enam niklafim b'yad. What? So what that I can't, you cannot remove these scales just with a hand. V'halo niklafim v'kli. They can be removed using a utensil. V'gam nisiti la'achar shishara v'kli sheni v'mayim. I also experimented that this thing soaked in some warm water. Min ha'efer shekorim loig, with a solution of lye. Kamo shalosha ot niklafu v'yad. After it was soaked in lye for about 3 hours, these scales were removable by hand. Uladaati, afilu lo hayu niklafim kodem shviya klau, rak achar shvili kliya hanel, gam kenu siman tahara. The fact that these scales could be removed, even if I could only remove them with a utensil after soaking in this lye, is enough to indicate that this fish is permissible. Ve'ein lomar shashviya b'mayim azim hanel garam lo shilik lufu. You can't argue that the fact that it was soaked in lye caused these scales to be removed. The mabakach, who cares whether they were soaked in lye. Soap, soap, shiryon kas kasim ulavosh. It's a scale. This fish has a scale. The guf ha-chumra, the very chumra prohibition, shehim si rabbeinu ramban b'perush ha-torah b'perek shmini, the very existence of this a strict ruling that the Ramban invented in his commentary that we read at the beginning of this hour, she'im einam niklafim klal lo nachush bo l'simim tahara, that if these scales cannot be scraped off, they don't count as scales, il malei amwa adam acher, had anyone else said such a thing, hayiti dan kenegda, I would have argued strongly against it. Uma b'kach she'im niklafim, what does it matter that these scales cannot be scraped off? Where do you find anywhere in the Gemara, either in the Bavli or the Yerushalmi, that scales have to be removable by peeling them off? Or in the Perush to the Midrash on Vayeshua. Adarava, the Mishnah Amru Kas Kasim Hakvuimbo. Clear interpretation of the Mishnah is that scales are fixed ingredients on the skin. Ramban Shamba Perush Nidchak Bazeh, and the Ramban himself had difficulty with this. For Katav in Ein Niklafim Lo Nikra Lavush, Shareihem Lukim Baor. Vani Omer Shaor Atzmo VeGam HaBasar Nikra Lavush VeChen Kdiv O Basar Talvisheni VeChulu VeYesh LeDkol Tzav. It's a covering.
They could just peel off the skin.
Right, so he says that something being called lavush doesn't necessarily mean that it's easily peeled off. So what he's saying is basically the Ramban invented this particular chumrah, and had anyone else said it aside from the Ramban, especially, I'm adding, if you say it simply in a perush on the Torah, but not in a halachic work, who cares? V'amnam, he writes, midivrei rabotenu ba'alei ha-talmud hayali la'avis stira. I can bring a contradiction to this position. The perak eimam midin da'chlamatet amalala natei la'adiyoma chaza da'havi b'al-simchi v'shara. That there was a question of whether this particular fish had scales, and the Amora held it up and saw against the light, and the scales were small or something, and not easily visible, and he held it up against the light, and they were visible. With the way Ramban, ma b'chach t'chazi la'in Hashem, shahayu bo tzimchi. According to the Ramban, who requires that the scales be easily removed, what did it help him that he was able to see scales on this fish by holding it up against the sun? Akati manye marshani klafimimen. How would he know by holding it up against the sun that these scales could be peeled off? Bayolo nasot elabadai, the whole hecha the emet hayu kaskasim lo ichpat lag in the klafim. So therefore I have proof, he says, from the Gemara, that the Ramban's requirement that the scales be removed by hand or utensil, be easily removed, contradicts the clear statement of the Gemara. Aval ma'ese, but what can I do? Rabbeinu ha-gadol ha-ramban amra, v'harav ha-magid v'perek aleph v'mimahalot ha-sorot aviyot, they rav ha-magid mishnah, brought this Ramban, v'harav beit Yosef, v'reish simin tegel, v'gibel ha-diyo, and the Rabbi Yosef Karo brought him in his parish on the Torah Shulchan Aruch, v'haramah kav'o v'hagara, and the Rama also brought this Ramban. We have to bow down and follow what they say, even though I know it's wrong. Aval al kol panim. But okay, so we have to accept the idea that the definition of a scale requires that it be removable. Aval al kol panim shol kol shenikrafim yeh al yedei eze pohu lashi yeh. Anything that can be peeled by any method whatsoever, kvar hein nikrein kaskasim v'dag tahor. V'lachein yida shedag ze sheshalach l'kan tahoru v'li safei klal, v'im gam hamin ha-sheni sheizkir v'mechtavo yish lehem gam ken shirov kaskasim halolu, gam hein mutvorim v'lin shum chash. So there is a clear-cut decision and as we will see from the testimony of the son, he was referring to the sterlet, that the sterlet and any similar fish with similar properties is permissible. His arguments are, A, this chumrah that the Ramban invented contradicts the Gemara, so if not for the fact that I have a whole tradition of decisions which affirm the position of the Ramban, I would say that it's not required altogether. And B, okay, let's bow our heads to the Ramban and the people who've accepted his decision, but who says that you can't apply lye to remove it? And in fact, we know what the Odom Yehuda did not know, but what we know from the Ohel Moed that we saw last week, that the Ramban himself put the sturgeon in boiling water and was able to remove the scales and therefore and permitted it. Okay. The DNA and evidence will come next week when we have to...
Why did the Ramban, why did they assume that was acceptable, not the annual program? What would happen and say, okay, well, you can't do manual program, you boil it, you can do it, it dissolves.
What? But first of all, the Nobrita says, no one ever said in the Gemara or anywhere else that you have, that by definition the scale has to be removed.
Okay. Yeah. So why did they even bring that up?
So they brought it up for whatever reason, but the Nota Biuda says, okay, we'll accept the fact that you have to remove the scale, but who says that we can't remove it by chemical, with some chemical help or some physical, some heat help? I mean, I don't understand your question.
They're just trying to prove a point of it now.
The fact is that we will see next week. Okay, so the next tshuva, I hope to study next week, and now begins to get a bit technical, is the tshuva haftet in the Shelot tshuva Tanarivir. But this tshuva haftet was written by his son after his father's death. And people like Rishaber and others said, well, the Nota Biyahuda changed his mind. He regretted making this decision.
Yeah, I just don't wonder why his father died. And he sent him a
what do you mean?
He just said, we have to follow the advice of the Ramban, even though he said he was
serious. No, he didn't say that. He said...
Well, that's what he's saying. He goes to the position handed down by the
Ramban. No, you misunderstood. You misunderstand. He says that I really don't think that we should rely on the Ramban, but as you say, there's a tradition of holding it. But let's not take it too far. All that the Ramban requires that the scales be removable, but who says that the Ramban that requires that you have to remove them only with your hand or with a knife or with your fingernail? Maybe if you soak it in lye, it should also be removable. And therefore, this fish has scales which can be removed. And
okay, so then is he saying this is a permissible
fish? He's saying that this is a permissible fish. That's his decision. And he was unaware of the Ohel Moed that we studied last week, where there's absolute testimony that the Ramban himself put the fish in boiling water and was able to have, and the scales came out and therefore permitted that fish. So certainly the Nota Biyahuda, without knowing that particular source that we know, in fact, was true to the opinion of the Ramban. So this is the beginning of the fish story. Comes next, we will study a really angry tshuva by the Nota Biyahuda's son to Mr. Grishauger, whatever his name is, and saying, how dare you claim that my father changed his mind on this subject? Now, this is a bunch of lies, and here we go. Then we will study the tshuva, the tshuva of the Mordechai Bennett, which is also a strange, to my mind, tshuva. And if we have time, I will try to search for Chorin's original pamphlet. All I have is the pamphlet of this guy attacking Chorin upstairs, but the original pamphlet I couldn't yet get out of the Harvard Library. I may or may not get it for next week. Then we will study a tshuva of the son of the Chatam Sofer, also prohibiting this fish. And then we will study a very clear tshuva of the Marsham, who's the leading posek in Galicia at the end of the 19th century, who also, most of these people never performed any of these experiments, but the Marsham also made a careful experiment on the fish, and clearly designates its name and gives enough of a description of it that there cannot be any doubt that he's talking about the sterlet, and he permits the fish. On the other hand, Rabbi Hoffman, Malamed Lahoil, who was of Hungarian origin, even though he was in Hildesheimer's Academy in Berlin, prohibits the consumption of caviar. And then, if we have time, we will move it up until the 1950s or 1960s, and we will see that the OU prohibits this particular fish. This is, as I said, the question that you asked, why this controversy over fish particularly, I don't have a good answer to, but it definitely was there, and it was really a violent controversy. People were taking up arms, not literally, but... And my guess is that it probably had more to do with the personality of Aaron Chorin, who used this particular decision as an opening wedge to the Institute of Reforms in Hungary, and therefore it became controversial and a flag issue because of the personality of Aaron Chorin, which you can read about in great detail in the handouts that I gave. All right, we will stop here. Do you have anything to add about Chorin, the original Chorin?
No, you know, I know one of the descendants, a very prominent Hungarian and very rich. And in 1944, I think he was in Hungary. Mm-hmm. Chorin is a well-known name, but that's his Chorin, not the other.
Right, well, the other Chorin is also a well-known name.